I'm Dr. Emily Silverman, and welcome to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. Join us as we explore the latest advances, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we sit down with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Ilan Guterman. Ilan is a neurologist and clinical researcher who specializes in the care of patients who are in the hospital. She also has a master's degree in clinical research and studies gaps in care for patients with dementia and other neurological disorders. Ilan, welcome to Remo.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So, Ilan, I know as a neurologist, you take care of people with all sorts of neurological conditions, but talk to me a little bit about your connection to dementia care specifically, because I know that that's an area of passion for you.
Absolutely. I would say that my path towards really caring about dementia comes on two fronts. As you mentioned, clinically, I work as a neurohospitalist at University of California, San Francisco. And in that role, we see so many patients with dementia, seeing them in the emergency room, seeing them in the hospital. And the hospital can be such an inhospitable place for these patients with dementia that it really strikes you as a group where there is enormous opportunity to improve the care that we provide. And I think that seeing that gap every day has really made me passionate about trying to close it. So that brings me to the second hat that I wear, which is that of a researcher, where I really then get to not just take care of patients and try to improve their care when they're in the hospital, but think more broadly about how we can design systems to better care for patients with dementia. So I am a clinical researcher, and I've had the privilege of working with Kate Poussine at UCSF, who began this program called the Care Ecosystem, which I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about. And I get to think about how can we study a program that is designed to take care of patients with dementia better? Why does it work? How does it work? And how can we disseminate these sorts of models more broadly? It's been really amazing, I would say, to both study something and then see how the world of care actually changes. Now we now have this new guide model that CMS has come out with to change the way we care for dementia. And I don't really have any other research program that I'm connected with where I've so quickly seen what I've studied actually impact the way we deliver care. So that has been incredibly fulfilling, not to mention the whole research team is filled with people who are so like-minded and wonderful.
You mentioned that you're a neurohospitalist. So for people listening who don't know what that means that Ilan is a doctor who takes care of patients in the hospital as opposed to the clinic or the office. We've both worked in hospitals as doctors, and I'll say in my experience, it's pretty striking when a person comes into the hospital and gets confused. Something that I've seen in the past is they'll look up and they'll say, oh, I want to go over there into the kitchen to make some food, but they're not in their kitchen. They're in a hospital room. So, like, what are some other examples of how that confusion expresses itself in the hospital? What would a family member look for to know if their loved one is confused?
Thanks for bringing this up. It is such an important topic that's not talked about enough. I'll start by saying that confusion has many faces. What one friend might say about their father who's in the hospital may be different than what you're experiencing with your mother, and the doctor is saying, no, they both have delirium. And you're saying, oh, but these two people look totally different. So to start with, confusion looks different depending on who you are. And it can really range in severity. The type of confusion that we think about patients being prone to, this confusion called delirium, first and foremost is a problem with attention. So people becoming really inattentive. And that starts out by forgetting what day it is, by forgetting where you are and what happened, what conversations you're having. And then as that gets more severe, either because you're more stressed, you've stayed in the hospital for a longer period of time, or other sorts of medications which may increase your confusion, that can then progress to somebody becoming a little bit more agitated, progress to somebody developing hallucinations and starting to see people who are not there, people from their past. And on the flip side, we think of that as the hyperactive form of delirium, where you see a lot more symptoms. You can have more of a hypoactive state, a less active state, where instead somebody just comes across as much more somnolent, not responding to things, staying in bed all the time, falling asleep. And along with that, there are other sorts of signs that we can go into, like reversing your days and nights so that you're sleeping all day and then up during the night and totally confused. So that is a key feature of patients who develop confusion while they're hospitalized.
And it also doesn't help that in the hospital, lights are on at night, lights are off during the day, people are coming by all the time to bother you, to stick you with a needle, to draw labs, maybe somebody's put a catheter up you to collect your urine, and so now you are tethered to the bed with an IV pole and a catheter. So talk a little bit about those other environmental factors. So it's not just being in a different place, being in a different room, but what are some of the things that are happening in that place that can make the confusion, or as you said, the type of confusion that we're worried about, which is called delirium, worse?
When you're in the hospital, you can imagine there's a patient with dementia. They don't know that they're hospitalized because they have forgotten. And now all of a sudden, they have a tube coming out to help them pee. They've got an IV line in their arm. That in and of itself becomes another source of confusion because it can be very hard to piece your world together to understand what's going on. So those sorts of activities can be destabilizing in terms of orientation. And then in addition to that, when you add in uncomfortable procedures that lead to pain, the medications that we use to treat pain, those two things also can lead to delirium. And finally, the hospital is a terrible place to sleep. You were talking about people coming into your room to check your vital signs, to take you for your MRI scan at 2 a.m. in the morning. Now, when you add in not sleeping well or being in a room where you're not next to a window, so you can't figure out what time of day it is, now your sense of time also becomes obscured by being in the hospital, all leading to additional reasons to become more confused.
So if my loved one with dementia is in the hospital, is there anything I can do to help them? I would say in my experience working in the hospital, when the family members are there at the bedside with the patient, that can do a lot to try to reduce the confusion, you know, even something as simple as a familiar face, a familiar voice. Of course, we know caregiver burnout is a big problem and people have lives and people have jobs and they're not going to be able to be there next to their loved one in the hospital 24/7. But what advice might you have for family members and caregivers if someone does need to go to the hospital, how they can help or how they can advocate for their loved one?
I suppose lesson one is you can help. And knowing that you can, the things that you can do include providing reassurance and then creating an environment around your loved one's bed that helps keep them oriented and helps them remember where they are, who they are, and as we said before, what time of day it is, as another piece to this. I was thinking about delirium the other day and realizing when people are going to the hospital to deliver babies, we often think about a go bag because you know there are going to be set things in the hospital that you will need, hospital chargers, socks. I think in the world of somebody who has dementia going to the hospital, maybe there's an analogous go bag that caregivers can really think about. And in trying to think about what I would put in a go bag, it includes things like pictures of family members so that even when you're not there, you remember, oh, I feel reassured. Oh, I see my granddaughter. I am not in such a strange place. Or bringing things like glasses, because if somebody is visually impaired, not being able to see can be a source of confusion. Same for hearing aids. Same for even a charger for your phone so that that person can call people and continue to converse with familiar voices. And finally, knowing that this is a risk, the hope is that all providers in the hospital are going to be attuned to delirium prevention, but in reality, it's not always the case. So remembering as much as possible to be an advocate for having a bed that's placed near a window, to avoid checking vital signs if they're not necessary in the middle of the night. These are small things to at least have a conversation about, all the while just remembering, as Emily, you just said, that your loved one is in a place where they are theoretically safe, so you are not responsible for all of their care, and it's equally important that you as a caregiver are finding time to rest, finding time away from the hospital to maintain your resilience, because these can be prolonged transitions.
As a family member, I might be scared to ask questions of the doctor or the nurse. It can be intimidating to go to the hospital and it's this big, scary building and you get lost and everyone's there in white coats and they're saying words you don't understand and it can just be really overwhelming. And there's definitely, I think, a power differential there where the tendency might be for some people to just do whatever the doctor says or do whatever the nurses say. What advice would you have for people who maybe want to ask questions and speak up and advocate? Hey, do we really need to do that blood pressure? It's 11 p.m. Hey, I notice you're giving the medications at 4 a.m. Do you think we could give them at 8 a.m.? Questions like that. What might you say to someone who's like, oh, can I ask that? I didn't even know I could ask that.
First, I just want to validate that it is intimidating. It doesn't matter who you are to walk into any hospital and deal with all of these providers in a huge building where you're prone to getting lost. It is overwhelming, not to mention you're already dealing with all the stress of a loved one being hospitalized. And I say this as a physician. I remember my father-in-law was hospitalized and we were trying to find the doctor and ask to see the doctor for a meeting. And we're told, no, I'm sorry, that's not going to happen. And so what to do in that situation can be really difficult. And nobody is immune to having these challenges creep up. So just know you're not alone. Perhaps second, then, knowing that this is a challenging situation to be in, one strategy for being able to navigate this system involves finding people within the system that you do trust and can talk to. So you don't have to get along or trust every nurse, but if you do find a nurse who really is there and understands you, then that is your opportunity, I think, to ask questions. So starting with someone you're comfortable with. Also, knowing that there are certain members of the healthcare team that are also specifically there to coordinate with family members and navigate care. So social workers and case management, part of their mission is really being a liaison between patients and their families and other providers. And finally, I would say that there is no stupid question, that really it can be scary to say, I don't understand. But keep saying, I don't understand, and know that if you don't understand what is going on, that is a failure of the person trying to explain it to you. And so the real goal of you being in the hospital is to help advocate for your loved one. And the one thing that you would expect and hope from your providers is an adequate explanation of what is going on. And so knowing that that is within your right to ask for and not being afraid is something that I would encourage, even though I do recognize that it's sometimes a lot easier said than done. You know, it just actually makes me think about one additional thing, which is sometimes what we'll do in the hospital is we'll set up a family meeting. So there is a time when we can schedule all of the family members to come in, all the providers to come in and have everyone's questions answered. So if it's hard to find somebody on Monday morning, Tuesday afternoon, these random times when you're in the hospital, instead creating a designated meeting space and bringing the questions that you have can be another really effective way to make sure all of your questions are answered. Maybe I'll pose the question back at you, Emily. I don't know if you have anything else that you would recommend to the listeners.
I would just say ask questions. And that's what the doctors and nurses and other care providers are there for. And I think just knowing that that's available to you alone can be a really big epiphany for some people, because again, it's easy just to take what's thrown at you as the only option, but there are options and it's worth exploring them, especially if you're concerned that your loved one is getting confused, delirious, just thinking through ways that you might be able to keep them as oriented as possible during the hospital stay. So let's say my loved one has dementia, they get pneumonia, they come to the hospital, they get confused, they get delirious. You know, we're working on it. We're bringing in photos. We're putting in the hearing aids. We're opening the window during the day so that the sleep-wake patterns hopefully fall back into a normal pattern. And then the pneumonia goes away and it's time for discharge. It's time to go back home. Does the confusion go away when the person goes home? Does the person go back to quote unquote normal or go back to how they were before the hospitalization? Or are there long-term consequences of being in the hospital? Even if it's a short hospital stay, how are people in your experience? Because I know you do a lot of work with care transitions. What might happen when they come home? What might families expect?
It's important for everyone to understand that delirium really can last a long time. It may seem to come on suddenly. The day before you were in the hospital, your loved one was fine, and then the next day they're totally confused. And it may take weeks for that confusion to resolve, which means that somebody who has dementia who's hospitalized may be ready to leave the hospital because they no longer need IV antibiotics, they no longer need any close monitoring, and so it's time for discharge to avoid all of these other unintended consequences that we're talking about in terms of being in the hospital. Yet the delirium has not totally resolved, which means it is incredibly common for someone who has dementia to then leave the hospital and not be exactly where they were before. And that doesn't mean that that person is not going to get back to where they were before. That delirium does get better. That being said, there are times when people are in the hospital and can take a really long time and never quite reach that same cognitive level of functioning that they were before the hospital. And unfortunately, right now, it is really difficult for us in the hospital when a patient is being discharged for us to be able to look at the patient, look at the family and say, you know what, this is what life is going to look like in a week. This is what life is going to look like in 2 months. Unfortunately, it can be really variable. And so it's, I think, frustrating for family members to have to deal with that uncertainty. But in general terms, I would say thinking about delirium as a reversible state is reasonably accurate. And simultaneously knowing that sometimes when people are delirious, they might not get quite back to where they were before is also unfortunately common. So hopefully I'm finding some way to communicate that balance between those two facts.
That's my understanding too, which is that the confusion, the delirium it may take a while to clear up, but even if and when it does clear up, that the person just may not be the same as they were before. I remember with my mom, she had dementia from Parkinson's. She broke her hip and went to the hospital, got a hip surgery, and then came home, but was never really the same afterward. And I don't want to say that to scare people because, like you said, Alon, some people, they do recover and go back to normal or go back to how they were before. But talk a little bit about if it's not that the delirium stays, it's just that what? They're just a little bit more frail, a little bit more what?
It can be different things. It's important to remember that patients who have dementia often don't only have dementia. There are other diseases, whether it is heart failure, whether it is orthopedic issues, including fracturing one's hip, that can also be destabilized while you're in the hospital. So if you fall and you were already having trouble walking and now you've broken your hip, it's going to be really hard to get back to the degree of mobility that you were at before. And so one piece is that no matter who you are, you are going to take a hit, not just cognitively, but maybe in some other domain. And then from a cognitive standpoint, there is some data to suggest that delirium itself is what we would call neurotoxic. It's not great for the brain. And so what that means is the different portions of the brain which are responsible for answering complex questions, for remembering things, those mechanisms may themselves be less capable after the brain has had to experience a delirious state. Now, those changes are really small, and that's why we've had such trouble really understanding this relationship. And often when you're delirious, there's a lot of other things going on during your hospital stay. So the exact relationship between delirium and how your cognitive function may change after you've been in the hospital is a bit tough to be precise and predict for any given patient, but it's not a particularly good state for your brain to be in.
So for those listening who are thinking, well, gee, I'd like to prevent a hospitalization if I can, what are some ways that people with dementia and their families and caregivers can stave off a hospital stay or stave off hospitalization? What can they do to try to keep their loved one out of the hospital so that they don't have these side effects?
There are certain common issues that come up that lead to people being hospitalized when they have dementia. You just brought up one, which is falls. People who have dementia often can lose their balance for a variety of different reasons, whether it is their ability to coordinate their gait, or it's because in addition to dementia, they also have a neuropathy, which affects their ability to feel their feet. And so falls prevention would be one area where it's really important to look at your house and think about the bathroom. Do I have enough handlebars? How easy is it to get in and out of the shower? How are the steps laid out in my house and the rugs? And am I setting myself up for tripping? So one piece of that is falls prevention as a common form. Another one is medications. That taking 10 different medications over the course of a day is complicated. And it's really easy to forget a medication, take two of the medication, and then all of a sudden suffer some side effect that you don't normally have, and that brings you to the emergency department. So keeping track of medications and trying to avoid medication errors, as well as avoiding taking medications that are unnecessary or might lead to increased confusion, is going to be really important. And then finally, I'll mention we did some work actually through the care ecosystem looking at how caregiver burden really influenced whether a patient with dementia winds up in the emergency room, and showed that how the caregiver is doing really can impact whether or not the patient with dementia winds up in the emergency room. You can imagine that as a caregiver, you are responsible for so much. And when you get overburdened, that can lead to a variety of downstream consequences that can end in your loved one missing a medication, as we talked about, or having a urinary tract infection but not getting to the primary care provider in time. So now they need IV antibiotics instead of oral antibiotics. And so making sure to know that taking care of yourself as a caregiver is equally important is one other thing I'd just like to emphasize.
You just mentioned care ecosystem, and I think now is a good time, especially since we're talking about preventing hospitalization. Part of that is just getting really good dementia care and having a great dementia care team so that these issues don't pop up, or at least don't pop up as often. What is the care ecosystem?
The care ecosystem was a dementia program that was designed by Kate Poussin and others at the Memory and Aging Center at UCSF, others like Sarah Delaney. And the goal of the program is to assign every patient and their primary caregiver, not just a doctor, but a dementia coach. Now, this dementia coach, or what they call a care team navigator, is somebody who is not licensed like a nurse or like a pharmacist, but instead has been trained in dementia care to help the patient and their family members navigate the system, check in with them regularly to provide education around medications, around falls prevention, both these things, as well as around the behavioral symptoms that can come up when somebody has dementia. And so this care team navigator will meet with the patient and their caregiver every month to go over what's been going on medically, review some of these educational goals, and then serve as a liaison to other members of the team, whether it's your primary care provider, your pharmacist, a social worker, so that when you need support that dementia coach, that care team navigator can't provide, you can access the healthcare team member that would be most appropriate.
And there have been research studies comparing this style of care, the care ecosystem, with ordinary care. What is the difference between the care ecosystem and quote unquote regular care or ordinary care? And what does the research show when you compare the difference or compare the outcomes?
They had the opportunity to test the care ecosystem against standard care in a really large randomized trial a few years ago. The results were published in JAMA Internal Medicine, and the outcomes that they were really wondering about are, how does this impact the patient's quality of life? How does this impact whether the patient winds up in the emergency room or the hospital? And how does this impact the caregiver? And so across all those fronts, the randomized trials showed that when you are enrolled in a program like the care ecosystem, instead of just receiving what is our normal dementia care, which is, you know, you go to the doctor, you email them when you have problems, you have appointments every 6 or 12 months, that the care ecosystem does lead to improvements in quality of life, decreased use of the emergency department, and a caregiver who winds up feeling less burdened and less depressed. And that was for patients and caregivers who were involved with the program for just a year. And now actually they're wondering, really, how long do you have to be in this sort of program? Do these benefits continue to accrue, or is there a plateau and you sort of get all the education that you need in 1 year? And that is a lingering research question and a lingering question that will be answered hopefully soon, as they continue to keep participants enrolled in the program for 5 additional years, and we'll be looking at how these patients did over time.
Wow, it's amazing that the outcomes were so much better even after just 1 year. And if I had to predict, I'm not a researcher and I'm certainly not a psychic or I don't have a crystal ball, but if I would have to predict, I would guess that 5 years is even better because we know that dementia is a lifelong journey. It's not a one-year journey. It's not even a five-year journey. For some people, it's a 5, 10, 20-year journey. And so it'll be really interesting to see what the research shows 5 years out and maybe even beyond.
Maybe I'll just add one thing on top of that, which is it is really interesting to see what it will show. And in addition to that, one aspect of the care ecosystem program is that all of the care is delivered remotely. So you might ask, are there particular settings that it really works well in? So not only do we want to know, are there people who have been in the program for 5 years and they just get more and more benefit, but are those who have less access to care because they live in rural areas actually benefiting more from this sort of program, which we think that's true. And similarly, if somebody has more severe dementia and needs potentially more support, are these the type of patients that really benefit from this sort of program? So there really are many different ways to target those who might benefit most from this sort of work and make sure that they are enrolled for as long as they are deriving benefit.
Yeah, we think a lot about telemedicine or virtual medicine or internet medicine or phone medicine as being something that came out of COVID times because people couldn't do things in person. And so now we have this explosion in telemedicine. But I feel like for dementia care, it makes a lot of sense, especially as you said, as dementia progresses, people may have frailty, difficulty getting in and out of bed, difficulty walking, difficulty getting in and out of a car, driving to the doctor, getting to the office, sitting in the waiting room. I mean, it's just, it could take half a day or more just to go to the doctor and talk to them for 20, 30 minutes. Talk a little bit about those benefits of, like, specifically for people living with dementia, why virtual care might be a benefit.
Absolutely. I think that in the past, we used to have these home-based primary care programs where a physician would be able to go to the home of the patient and take care of them. And that's incredible for somebody who is unable to walk around the house easily, let alone get out of the house, get into a car, get into the elevator, up to the doctor's office. But the problem is it's impractical to disseminate that. We're already in this moment where we don't have enough doctors to care for patients, including patients with dementia. So I see telehealth, whether it's telephone or video or audio or, you know, just being able to message your providers back and forth as a real opportunity to get the healthcare team in the house, if not physically, digitally. And that allows more and more people to access care and allows more and more people to access not just their doctors, but access other members of the healthcare team. So I really think that if you were trying to close your eyes and envision what dementia care looks like in 5 to 10 years, even before COVID, it would be very easy for people to realize that we need to move in this direction. And thankfully, I think we are.
I love this thought experiment of let's all close our eyes and imagine the dementia care of the future 5, 10 years from now. What could it look like? And maybe I'll just toss it back to you for this final question. What do you hope to see over the course of your career? You're still fairly early in your career. You're young. You have your whole physician life ahead of you. You'll probably see so many different patients. So what are your visions, your hopes, your dreams? Is it care ecosystem across the entire United States? Is it that and more? Is there a different idea that you have? Or what do you imagine coming up the road?
It's a big visioning exercise. As far as goals for the future, I think that if we can get to a place where the patient with dementia, I have to close my eyes to envision this, for the patient with dementia and their caregiver, if we can get to a place where they are both feeling satisfied and both feeling their needs met by the care that we're providing, that would be an incredible place to get to and should be our goal. So first of all, just remembering that although we focus on a patient with dementia, that the caregiver really does become a second patient, and programs like the Care Ecosystem, programs like the one Remo is developing as well and delivering, are focused on making sure that we're not forgetting the caregiver. And then if I were to think about the components of the care that they would be getting, I think that you would have not just a doctor assigned to a patient, but you would really have a team that's thinking holistically. And holistically means taking care of clinical issues and taking care of clinical issues across a network of medical providers who all know what's going on. And also a program that would be able to support a patient and their caregiver in all of these ancillary needs that come up that I think the healthcare system right now does a poor job, honestly, providing. And so that means accessing community resources, both for socializing as well as for providing basic needs like food. And similarly, thinking about the legal needs that come up and the financial needs that may come up for a patient with dementia, knowing that these are not classically clinical issues, yet they are so deeply tied to how somebody is doing cognitively that for the medical field to ignore those issues does a huge disservice to our patients right now. And then one piece that we have not really spoken about this conversation is long-term care. And there's huge improvements that we need to make in terms of helping families decide when it's appropriate for a patient to no longer be at home if they need to be in another facility to help care for them, and then how to make that transition in a way that upholds the dignity of the patient and meets their needs and is also in line with what the caregiver wants for the patient as well and what the caregiver wants for themselves.
That's a beautiful vision. It's more than just doctors, right? It's social, it's financial, it's nutritional. It has to do with what resources you have access to. And these are things that traditionally the medical system has ignored. So how do we bring all of those aspects together to provide wraparound care for families? And it'll be exciting to see how that evolves. And I'm just really grateful that you came here today to speak about your experience taking care of dementia patients inside the hospital, but also outside of the hospital, and all of your research with Care Ecosystem. It's been such a wonderful and rich discussion. So thank you so much, Dr. Ilan Guterman, for coming on to Remo.
Thanks so much for having me. It's rare to have the opportunity to reflect back about what care looks like, as well as reflect forward and think about the future. So I thought the conversation was thought-provoking, and I hope to be back.
Thanks for listening to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. If you're looking for more information, resources, and expert insights, visit remo.health and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Until next time, take care.